Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
All right, in no particular order, here's where we are late of a Friday in early August. Online dating on the broadcast today, Iraqi infrastructure, and your credit score as well. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Friday, the 8th of August, is what my calendar says. Great, as always, to have you with us. There was a second round of American airstrikes in northern Iraq today near the city of Erbil against the ISIS militants who've been enjoying quite a bit of success in that region. Yesterday, they took a key piece of Iraqi infrastructure, the Mosul Dam. We've called up Tim Arango to get a little context on that. He is the Baghdad bureau chief for The New York Times, and we got him, as you will hear, on his phone line in Baghdad. Tim, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. A pleasure.
Tell me about this dam. Where is it? Why does it matter?
It's 30 miles northwest of Mosul. It is enormously important because it's the country's largest dam. It regulates the water supply and the water levels all along the Tigris River, electricity for Mosul. And if it collapsed, it would cause a catastrophe of enormous proportions. It's quite ominous to think about what they could do.
We'll get to that in a minute, because they have actually used water as a weapon before. But on this dam specifically, it controls electricity up in that part of the country. It controls water flow for the people in that part of the country. And they could, ISIS, I imagine, use it to extort payments and monies, right? If you want the lights on, pay us.
Yeah, that's the flip side to using it as a weapon of war. They can use it as a method of finance, which I think, at least in the short term, is far more likely. They've shown ISIS a great ability to be self-supporting and self-financing, and a great ability to carry out extortion schemes. And so it could be a great source of money for them to continue their operations.
There are other dams in Iraq that ISIS controls, and they have a number of weeks or months ago actually opened up some of those dams and flooded land down near Fallujah, right?
Actually, one dam, the Fallujah Dam, which they captured earlier this year, and they did open it up. They flooded Fallujah, parts of Fallujah. So there are people fleeing and had their houses destroyed, not from the fighting, but they were fleeing because of the flooding. So it gave a window on what they could do.
What do you suppose happens next, just to get back to the Mosul Dam up in the northern part of the country? What happens? Do they hang on to it and say, we've got it and we're gonna use it to our fullest extent?
I would suspect that, you know, their whole thing seems to be, you know, brutality, yes, but also state building. And it doesn't seem to be in their interest to, like, unleash this catastrophe over Mosul. I mean, people say it would send a 65-foot wave over Mosul. So I don't see them doing that. Now, the problem, though, is to launch a military operation to retake it would be extremely difficult, because the dam itself, regardless of if they want to sabotage it, it's very fragile. The Americans were trying to fix it. The Iraqis didn't keep that work up. And so some of the experts I spoke to said, you know, a very small crack in that dam could just start the water flowing. And so that's another big question. Do they have the capability to maintain it?
What's it like infrastructure in, just say, Baghdad now where you are? Do you have electricity 24 hours a day? Can you get around and go places?
Well, with electricity, it's always been a problem. I've been here for now almost 5 years, and often our biggest expense at the Bureau was, fuel for the generator. Every neighborhood has a generator you have to tap in, and the electricity, the city electricity, comes and goes. In the winter months, you get a lot more because people aren't running air conditioners, and in the summer months, you can have just a few hours a day of the city electricity.
Tim Arango, the New York Times bureau chief in Baghdad. Tim, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Geopolitics of a different sort seem to drive the markets today. Word that Russia has ended military exercises near Ukraine coincided nicely with a rally in the three major indices. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's good news today on the personal finance front. The calculations and quite possibly the alchemy that go into determining the most influential credit score that consumers get, known as a FICO score, those calculations are changing. Most particularly, people with unpaid medical bills could be getting a break. From the help desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein explains what makes medical debt different.
To answer that, let's go shopping.
When you go to the Gap to buy jeans, you ultimately know at the time of purchase exactly what the cost of that is going to be.
Ken Brevoort is a senior economist with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Brevoort says when you pay for your 1969 Ultimate Panel Cuffed Always Skinny Jeans, you are the only person paying the bill. When you go to that doctor, usually it's you and the insurance company.
When you have the insurance involved, you don't necessarily know what's going to be your portion and what's going to be the insurance's portion. So it may be that there winds up being a bigger bill that you're responsible for than you really expected.
Here's the thing. Paying medical bills is so complicated, sometimes the consumer doesn't even know when they still owe money. And that is what makes medical bills different. That, and it's often an unplanned event. FICO spokesperson Anthony Sprav says ignorance isn't a good reason to give someone a lower FICO score.
We recognize that it is not an indicator of someone struggling in most cases when it's happening by itself.
The federal government estimates about 7% of consumers have unpaid medical bills that have gone to collection agencies. Those consumers could see a 25-point or better score under FICO's change, says Sprav.
They're going to have access to more credit, and they're going to be able to get credit at a lower price.
That's the good news. The bad news is more and more consumers must wade into the Byzantine world of healthcare billing, which means if you want to make sure you're up to date on your bills, it's all on you. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Next week, the London-based system for setting the price of silver, a system that has been around for more than 100 years, is going to be scrapped. In its place, a new electronic auction-based system is going to be put into place, which is highlighting the flaws in an arguably more important precious metal price-setting mechanism. For almost a century, the price of gold has been set, also in London, twice a day. But after a series of scandals, what is called the gold fix is looking more than a little, well, tarnished. From London Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Set up in the clubby atmosphere of London in 1919, when market players were all regarded as gentlemen, the gold fix looks out of date today. The name doesn't help. Fix hardly inspires confidence in the integrity of the system these days, especially, says Brian Lucy of Trinity College Dublin, especially since banks are involved.
People don't trust banks. I wonder why that is.
Four banks, including Barclays and HSBC, get together on the phone twice a day and deal in gold bullion. The price they strike becomes the latest fix or global benchmark for the yellow metal. Not an ideal system, says Lucy.
It needs to be a process which is clean and transparent and seen to be so. What we have at the moment is not transparent, and therefore it inevitably gives rise to conspiracy theories and concern.
Details of the dealing between the four banks are not immediately made public, and that provides scope for dishonesty, as Alberto Thomas of market consulting firm Fideres Partners recently testified before a parliamentary committee.
Effectively, you've got a massive potential for insider trading in that market and market manipulation. It doesn't mean it happens every day, but the opportunity is there.
He claims that between 2010 and 2013, up to 30% of the fixes showed signs of rigging. Adrian Ash of BullionVault.com, an online gold and silver exchange, is not convinced there has been such widespread abuse, but he concedes there has been at least one case of gold fix manipulation.
Barclays Bank were recently fined £26 million for a trader on a separate precious metals desk at their bank who put in basically a false order at the fix to try and push the price a little bit lower.
The trader stood to get a bigger bonus if the gold price fell below a certain level. This is not the biggest banking scandal to hit London, but, says Adrian Ash, it could be yet another blow.
I think there is a danger of the reputation of the London bullion market being damaged by the current fuss around the fix, and I think that would be a shame.
Without greater transparency and independent oversight, the fix could wither and this city could lose more business to the burgeoning gold market in Shanghai. When the silver fix here reforms itself next week, gold may not be far behind. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Geopolitics and the price of gold aside, there are a couple of other things to talk about economy-wise as we wrap up the week that was. For that, we've got Jolene Kent from Fox Business, Felix Salmon from Fusion. Hello to you both.
Happy Friday.
Okay.
Happy Friday indeed. Joe, we will start with you. And since Stephen just wrapped us up out of Europe, I want to stay there for a minute. What is going on over there? We've got that Portuguese bank that's in some trouble, Banco Espírito Santo. We've got Italy in a triple dip recession, we learned this week. The German economy is slowing. Hello? Come on.
Hello is right. It is a really tough situation over there right now. And taking a look at GDP across the Eurozone, mm-hmm. it's also not really good. In fact, a lot of it seems to be the issue with geopolitics with Russia. Right. You have Germany and Russia with their trading limitations now, and that really will take a hit for the economy. It's really tough right now.
Felix, contagion is the word I want to throw to you with.
When Europe sneezes, the Americas catch a little bit
out.
Of a cold. Something.
Really?
I don't
Come on.
Know. Not really.
All right.
I don't think. We've seen a series of massive European crises over the past few years, mm-hmm. and even a massive European crisis doesn't seem to have a particularly noticeable effect on the U.S. economy. So this little wobble that we're seeing right now, although it's very bad for Italy, I don't think it's going to be very bad for the U.S.
All right, good. We will leave Europe there then and move on to the American economy. The Federal Reserve and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation were out with a pair of reports this week about the banking sector and about these living wills that Wall Street big banks have to put together as part of the Dodd-Frank reform program and talking about how they're going to wind themselves down if they get into trouble. And both reports basically said, you know what? This is fantasy. You guys aren't doing anything to make yourselves safe, and American taxpayers are going to get stuck again. Joe, how is it that 6 years now after the crisis, we're still here?
Well, what I would love to see is those letters from the Fed with a specific criticism yeah. for each of those 11 banks. That would be so fascinating. But it seems the market, looking at this, is kind of shrugging it off. If you look at this week, financials stocks, they're actually up 0.6%.
Well,
and that's
of course
actually
they
double
are.
The S&P 500.
I mean, the market's been shrugging off everything since,
that's
I don't
true.
Know, March of 2009.
The banks are
it
not going to
banks,
get shrunk. The banks are not going to worry about this. So, and ultimately, the Fed's not going to do anything
so
about it.
So that means profits stay high, Felix? Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. The regulators are showing a little bit of backbone here. They're saying, come on, banks, get real about this. There's this government backstop, and you're not doing anything to stop us from having to bail you out. But the banks are saying, well, fine, if you're going to bail us out, we're not going to worry.
Do you either of you think that the banks can basically blow off the Fed and the FDIC and not come back with more stringent living wills, Joe?
It seems that they're going to stretch it as long as humanly possible because they've had all this time. They still haven't done it. They clearly know exactly what they're doing.
Sure. Sure. Felix,
I don't think it's possible. I don't think there's anything they actually can do which will satisfy the FDIC or even the Fed for that matter because they're just too big. The only thing which will really work would be to break themselves up, and they're not going to do
that. Yeah, no, that's never going to happen. All right, item number three on my list. We got about a minute left, and I want to talk, Felix, this one's for you, but Joe, I want your thoughts as well. The 10-year Treasury is at 2.4%, and yet, so it's people are piling in there. They're driving the yields down because they want quality. They want the risk-free nature of American debt, Felix, but the economy's good, the stock market's high, everything's fine. Why are people nervous and why are interest rates so low?
Why are people nervous? Do you remember what happened at the beginning of your show? There's major geopolitical unrest.
Wait, what? Huh?
That's exactly what it is. It's Ebola, it's ISIS in Iraq, there's a new war in Iraq possibly, there's Syria, there's Ukraine, there's a huge amount of geopolitical turmoil right now, and when you get that, you get a flight to quality.
Joe?
Yeah, I agree. I think that you see volatility is up for the moment, but it's still near record lows. You have three major issues going on across that entire region. It's a safe haven.
All right. We shall see. We'll get you back in a month, Felix. We'll figure it out, all right?
Thanks.
All right. Felix Salmon from Fusion and Jolene Kent from Fox Business. Felix also, by the way, does a podcast at Slate, the Slate Money Podcast, which I am mentioning, Felix, just to point out that I have yet to be invited on.
You're on next week.
All right, we'll see you guys later. Bye.
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 Coming up,
If the goal of the dating site is to get you offline and into the real world with your life partner, they probably wouldn't offer a subscription service.
Love is a business, y'all. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here we go. The Dow Industrial's up 185 points on this Friday, 1.1%, closed at 16,553. The NASDAQ charged up 35 points, 0.8%, ended things at 4370. The S&P 500 put on 22 points, 1.1% there as well, wrapped at 1931. Given how bad it was in the middle of the week, you might be surprised that the Dow and the S&P both gained 0.3% on the week. The NASDAQ added 0.4% Monday through Friday. Zynga has games like Farmville, Castleville, Cityville, even Chefville. You know what it doesn't have? A positive revenue flow. The social game developer wilted 1.3% today. Two media corporations, two contrasting results. CBS beamed up 4% on good earnings. News Corp slid 1.5% after missing revenue projections. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. He's one of the founders of Apple. Steve Wozniak turns 64. The Expendables 3 has its Los Angeles premiere. It opens in theaters later in the week. And 80 years ago, on August 11th, 1934, Alcatraz Federal Penitentiary welcomed its first group of prisoners. Probably not a red carpet event. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There's a growing digital divide between the U.S. and Europe. And I'm not talking about technology in and of itself here. More about data. Your data, who can get it and what they can do with it. Online privacy in this country consists of what you might call a patchwork of laws, a little bit here and a little bit there. Europe, on the other hand, takes a more blanket approach. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has the compare and contrast.
This is the tale of two online privacy activists, one in San Francisco.
I'm Parker Higgins.
Hi, Parker.
And one from the Netherlands.
My full name is Xander Bouwman.
Parker is 26. Xander is 21. Parker works for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Xander is an information sciences student and volunteer activist. Now, there's a lot of debate over whether U.S. or EU online privacy protections are better. They certainly take different approaches, as Xander made clear to Parker.
Parker, I'm going to teach you now for a little bit because I think that we as Europeans have it pretty good here.
Xander tells Parker EU privacy law actually guarantees protection of personal data, and new digital privacy legislation being considered by the European Parliament would strengthen those guarantees. So, for example, if Xander did a Google search, Google would have to tell him before it shared his tracking information outside the EU. Xander likes that.
So, I would want to know if Google is behind the page and using analytics to make a profile of me.
And when Xander logs into Facebook, he has the right to access all of the data Facebook has on him. Parker doesn't have that.
We're bound by websites' privacy policy, and we know that, you know, like everyone who's seen one of those knows how ridiculous they can be, and they can change at any time.
But Europe isn't perfect. It would actually be almost impossible for Xander to get his Facebook data because enforcement in Europe isn't so great. It's up to privacy regulators, who don't have much power, as Parker points out.
Yeah, I mean, can I say, Xander, that the laws are important here, and it's great that this is happening in Europe, and you know, I'm jealous of it in the U.S. But at the same time, if it's about enforcement, you know, these companies can collect sort of whatever they want.
Yeah, Parker, I can only agree with you here.
Now, Parker and Xander aren't lawyers, so I'm going to bring a law professor into the conversation here, David Sorkin. He teaches information technology and privacy law at the John Marshall Law School in Chicago. He says, in the U.S., we enforce our digital privacy rights privately.
That is the right to sue, and sometimes that would have to be in the form of a class action. Whereas in the EU, it's mostly data protection commissioners, regulators who impose the rules and enforce them.
The data protection legislation the EU Parliament is considering would give privacy regulators a lot more enforcement power. U.S. tech lobbyists and government officials say the EU legislation is too rigid, and the U.S. system is more nimble with its many different privacy laws, covering everything from health data to video rental records. Simon Davies is founder of Privacy International.
There's a huge gulf across the Atlantic, which is taking many years to resolve, and I think it's many years off yet.
But our 20-somethings don't want to wait that long. Xander Bouwman says they're taking things into their own hands.
I held a crypto party in Amsterdam a few months ago.
Yep, he he said crypto party. Sender says it's just a chance for privacy nerds to get together and swap tips for evading online profiling and tracking.
It might sound really wild because it's called a party, but usually we host these at public libraries.
Parker Higgins says it's not just a European thing. He holds crypto parties too. Parker and Zander say if they crypto party hard enough, they can stitch together their own privacy blanket. They hope eventually pokey lawmakers and government officials will catch up. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
All right, now the flip side, if you will, of online privacy. Online dating. Used to be there was kind of a stigma attached to finding love online. We are emphatically over that. It is now a $4 billion industry worldwide. There are hundreds of dating sites out there, which means, of course, that profit motives are starting to take the place of true love. Dan Bobkoff has the story.
The other week, Alex Soma was out in the real world looking for a match at a rooftop drinks event sponsored by a couple of online dating sites.
I think I'm pretty terrible at online dating. I just don't get it. I'm much better in front of a person.
So far, he just uses the site OkCupid. But others I met there, like Christina Luzzi, sound like they're becoming veterans.
I've tried Tinder. Plenty of Fish was the first one I tried. That was awful. I've tried Match. I think OkCupid. What am I on now? I'm on eHarmony, I think.
And while all those sites sound like separate competitors, a good number are part of just one company called IAC, or Interactive Corp. In recent years, IAC has swallowed up old stalwart Match.com, the irreverent and young OkCupid, the fast-swiping Tinder app, and just recently, an upstart called How About We? It owns niche sites like Black People Meet and Our Time for the 50-plus set, and it's investing in an expensive new matchmaking service.
What IAC is doing is incredibly smart.
Amy Webb is author of Data, A Love Story. She says IAC is operating kind of like The Gap, which owns Old Navy and Banana Republic.
At the end of the day, they're all clothing, but they offer different kinds of clothing to different lifestyles, different kinds of buyers.
Industry consultant Mark Brooks says he used to think the future of online dating was in small niche sites, matching farmers or people who don't eat gluten, or gluten-free farmers. But he says it's the big sites that are winning for a simple reason.
It's like a shop. You've got to stock the shelves. And you've really got to stock the shelves. You can't make do with a few hundred people. You need to have thousands of active people on a dating site.
Each of these mainstream sites has carved out its own image, partly by word of mouth.
The reality is people feel at home when they go to a dating site that has people on it that look just like what they think they want.
I joined OkCupid back in November 2009, right after I moved to Brooklyn from Los Angeles. I was referred to it by a close friend of mine from high school who I trusted.
This leads to some self-segregation. OkCupid is full of people like Erica Berger, 27, living in a big city, working in media, and not in a rush for a relationship.
The first date that I went on was actually a butternut squash tasting date.
She's also used IAC-owned apps like Tinder, popular for quick dates, and How About We, which is all about specific date ideas. But she hasn't used Match, whose users tend to be older and more interested in marriage. This is why IAC doesn't just combine all the sites into one. Sam Yagan is the CEO of IAC's Match Group.
It turns out that dating is such an intimate and personal category, such an intimate and personal search process, that people care a lot about the emotional affiliation they have with the brand that they choose.
The strategy has led IAC to control more than a quarter of the $2 billion online dating market in the U.S. That's twice the next biggest competitor, eHarmony. Yagan says Match Group runs all the services separately. You don't see OkCupid staffers talking much to those from Match.com. But there is potential cross-promotion.
It's not like you turn 35 and we just sort of all of a sudden take your profile from OkCupid and stick it on Match. You might start seeing Match ads when you turn 35 on OkCupid.
And author Amy Webb says you have to question the business model.
If the goal of the dating site is to get you offline and into the real world with your life partner, they probably wouldn't offer a subscription service.
Yagan has an answer to this that's less conspiratorial, but more depressing.
The average adult has over 10 relationships before they get married. And then, by the way, half of all marriages end in divorce. So if you just do the math, there's a 90%+ chance that the relationship you're in when you leave Match, OkCupid, Tinder is not going to be your terminal relationship.
Ouch. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, in which I reveal a pet peeve about how I sound on the radio. When I listen back to myself in interviews, I'm struck by how often I say, as I'm putting together a question. Kind of bugs me, makes me sound stupid, I think, but it's how I talk, so I roll with it. But it turns out I am completely normal. A post at The Atlantic that I saw today quotes a linguist at the University of Pennsylvania who studies this stuff, who says men use more and more as they get older. Women use but that use decreases with age. What that has to do with the marketplace angle, I have no idea, but I thought it was interesting. Also, it's Friday, so there you go. All right, we are done on a Friday. Today, the Dow up about 185 points, the NASDAQ 35, the S&P 500 added 22 points, up all the way around. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Yor. The program is produced by Sitara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I am Kai Ristel. We'll see you Monday, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.